our budgets are external expressions of our values, right? And so to the extent that you can communicate those values with someone else before you get into the place where you're spending money, it's just going to serve you well.
Welcome back to the Most Hated F-Word podcast. I am your host, Sean Maslach, and I am pleased you are here for another fascinating conversation. This week, I speak to Abby Davison. She's an author, speaker, and Fortune 200 leader turned entrepreneur. Abby is really passionate, and you hear this throughout the episode, about helping people make better money decisions. She focuses on how intertwined love and money are. I agree with Abby. Too often, we dance around the topic or we avoid the topic that money and love are so intertwined. We say that we're just with this person because we dearly love them. Abby and her co-author, Meyer Strober, really talk about how there is an underlying influence money plays on love and love plays on money. And bringing awareness to that influence can really help us have a meaningful and strong relationship and financial life. Abby is now the co-founder and CEO of Money and Love Institute. Abby's education background is a BA from Yale University and an MBA in education from Stanford University. Stanford is where she first attended the class with her co-author, Maya Strober, where eventually, over a decade later, they unite to co-author this wonderful book, Love and Money. During this conversation, Abby shares a lot about her personal relationship with money as she used the tools in the book to navigate her own personal life. We discuss many concepts from her book, including the 5C framework.
There are monkey wrenches that get thrown at us all the time that you don't anticipate, right? So the framework is not going to guarantee that everything goes right, but it can guarantee that you both feel good about the way you made the decision and have confidence in your approach, which helps when an outcome is uncertain or is not the one you anticipated.
I appreciated how Abby really brought forward this idea how deeply interconnected, not just love and money, but also our emotions and many other aspects in our lives and how they're all interconnected and influence big life decisions. I highly encourage everyone to grab a copy of Abby's book, Love and Money, and check out her wonderful work at the Money Love Institute. If you've been enjoying the podcast, you can support the show in one or two ways. You can head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or you could send this episode to family, friend, or colleague. And now, I hope you enjoy this fascinating conversation with Abby Davison. Abby, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Sean. I'm so happy to be here.
I am happy to have you here as well. We were just chatting before we started recording about how intertwined love and money are. And it just got me thinking even more is how little I think we realize they are actually intertwined into every single nuance and fabric of the two existence of love and money. So I'm excited to really peel open the layers and dive into how these two things are so connected with you.
Yeah, it's so interesting, right? We're taught very early on to compartmentalize and to make financial decisions, career decisions with our heads and to analyze them and not let emotion get in the way, right? And then, but for relationships, we should follow our hearts and not let our analytical minds interfere or think about money in the context of relationships because that's materialistic, right? And so we have this way that we're socialized that is really flawed, and actually all of life's big decisions, including the person you spend your life with, if you decide to do that, have a component of money and a component of love to them. And so if you are ignoring half of that, you're making decisions that are likely to be flawed, that are likely to not take the full picture into account. And that's when we run into trouble and make choices that we might regret.
So are you suggesting that we marry for money?
I'm suggesting that there are many elements and factors that go into a relationship. And my co-author is a labor economist, and she talks a lot about the marriage markets, right? There is an element of marriage. And actually, if you go back in time, it was much more transparent that this was an exchange of resources. So people would get married because their land was next to the land of the prospective partner, right? Or because there was an advantageous business connection to be made through that union. And we have sort of convinced ourselves over time that we now marry for love only, but that's not the case. We haven't gotten completely away from that historical fact that marriage can either improve our financial status or actually decrease it. And we need to be more having the conversations, at least, to surface some of the what's under the surface.
You know, I jokingly said that, but your response made me even, I guess, think more that, no, yeah, we do. It's okay. And it's okay that there are elements of us that marry for money, whether it's unconscious or below the surface, like you said. And I'm just even thinking about the complexities of our own relationships with money and how they're most of the time it's unconscious to us. But I'm just thinking of someone, say, for example, who maybe they grew up in a household that was very tight-fisted with money, and they weren't allowed to do extravagant or not even like random things. It was very according to the budget. You might unconsciously be attracted to someone who is more laissez-faire with their money. And as you start dating, like, whoa, you could order anything off the menu. And while you think you're married for love, which there's an element, I'm hearing you say there's even a deeper element. And I agree about this money story or the relationship of money that we have with ourselves, that we are attracted to the others. Am I making sense here?
You're absolutely making sense. And I think we don't often do the work ourselves to even become aware of our own money stories. And, you know, think about what was our mindset, you know, the mindset of the people who raised us around money, and how might that have influenced our own, and let alone, you know, talk to our partner or prospective partner about their mindset. And so, you know, there's a lot of trends on TikTok that I think are silly, but I think this trend towards loud budgeting and being honest and transparent with your friends and partners, prospective dates about your budget and about, you know, how much you can spend is a positive one, because it starts to get out those things that we sometimes hide for a very long time in relationships. And I've certainly been in relationships, you know, before I met my co-author and took her course, where we didn't talk about money, and we didn't, you know, even lived with someone who we didn't really discuss money, which is kind of shocking on one hand. On the other hand, I actually think it's quite common, and it's not the norm at all to have those transparent conversations about our money mindset and our money story and how that might interact with the person who we are spending a lot of time with.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I'm really hearing this. You can't really take them, like, you can't really separate them, and they're impacting, to use your words, the person we're interacting with. So perhaps having these conversations or reading books like this are going to normalize it to some degree. There's probably a lot of work to be done. As you're saying that, it made me think of my first restaurant date with my wife, which was a girlfriend at that time. I used a coupon. It was a 2-for-1. And in my household, we just used coupons all the time. And I thought it was totally normal. And I remember her being like, oh, okay, you're using a coupon. Just thinking back, I'm like, wow, that says a lot about my money story without even talking about it. But
I love that. Well, you know, she, at least you could say she went in with her eyes wide open, right? About
yeah.
Who she was ending up with.
And now she's like, oh boy, I didn't realize it was this crazy, but no. So you mentioned that our upbringing has a big influence on how we think, feel, and believe with money. And to your comment, often we don't understand the influence it has. When you look at your trajectory, I've heard you talk before how your parents, I guess, views in terms of their careers have really impacted you. And I just thought we would maybe link that to our conversation around, because I think it has to do with our money stories. But I understand that your father was big into the nonprofit world, and your mother was a librarian. And I heard you recently talk about how these two stories have, I guess, influenced the work you're doing. Maybe can you touch on how they have influenced you?
Yeah. I mean, I think we are so deeply influenced by our parents or the people who raised us. And in my case, you know, both of my parents were focused on, you know, helping others, right? My mom through opening people's eyes to the world of books and how reading could be not just a tool for education, but a tool for, you know, continuous learning and adventure and just so many wonderful things. And so books were really revered in my house growing up. In fact, my parents were absolutely coupon users, and my mom was a, yes, you know, shopped at consignment stores before that was cool, before vintage was a thing. And, you know, books were one of the things that we were allowed to spend whatever we wanted on. She would run the book fair of the school where she was a librarian. And I remember my brother and I would go to the book fair and we could get to pick out as many books as we wanted. And that was just like so in contrast to the more restrictive kind of cost-conscious way that we would budget for other things. And my father was a public health executive. And as you mentioned, he was worked for the same nonprofit actually for his whole career, the American Lung Association. And so this idea of helping people focus on their well-being through education, through programs that would help them find their way to better health outcomes was also something that was important. But broader, you know, just this idea that to have an impact in the world was to be of service and to really think beyond yourself as a way of leaving things better than the way you found them. And that was really profoundly influential for me.
And now you authored a book about leaving the world in a better place. It's interesting how both of those influences have commingled to this, I don't know, to this book. It really, I hear both of their stories coming through this book. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, no, I love that. And actually, my mom passed away and is no longer with us and didn't get to hold the book in her hand. But I talk a lot to my kids about her influence, and they're both voracious readers. And we talk about how important, you know, books have been, you know, in my childhood and to their childhood. And so I think the way that we talk to our kids about why we do what we do and why we are the way we are is really helpful, especially when someone influential to us is no longer there to make current memories. So I think it's really powerful to pass on those stories and those influences, especially when they don't know their grandmother. They didn't know her past, you know, very young age.
Mm-hmm. I find that we too often don't pass on stories. And I mean, humans have evolved based on stories. We relied so much on stories for most of the human existence. And it seems like we're at times too busy to tell these stories. So I agree. I love stories. Speaking of stories and books, you wrote a book, you co-authored a book, and you've mentioned your co-author a few times, Myra Strober. I find it interesting. You both seem to come from different walks of life. I don't know your age, but I don't think you guys are the same age or even
we're four relatively
close.
Apart.
Yeah, okay. Yes. She is an economist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And you are not an economist. And you both come together with these different worldviews, but a common, I guess, belief in love and money. Looking back, when you rewind and go all the way back to when you decided to take her course at Stanford, why do you think you initially were attracted to this course with the hindsight of today?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And I did a joint degree, a dual degree at Stanford. So I was getting my MBA and I was getting my master's in education at the same time. I've always been a translator between different worlds. And so that ability to straddle those two disciplines really appealed to me. But it meant that my classes were really very tightly constricted because I had to meet, I was trying to do the degrees in 2 years and I needed to meet the requirements without taking, you know, additional time. And that meant I had to take classes that satisfied both the requirements. And so those were a small number of classes. And I remember seeing this class as one that would actually meet both requirements. And it seemed so practical to me. There were a lot of classes in graduate school that would seemed more theoretical or sort of wasn't sure that, you know, I wasn't planning on running a corporate finance organization, right? So there were a number of requirements that felt like okay, not sure how this would be eminently useful in my foreseeable future, but this idea of making all the decisions you needed to make in life as someone who wanted to have a career and a personal life, and also was planning on managing others who wanted to be in the workforce and have priorities outside of their career, felt so useful to me. And it satisfied both requirements. And the man that I was dating at the time, who we had met in business school, was also interested in the course. And so it felt like it was this trifecta of it would satisfy my requirements, it would be useful. And I got to talk about these topics, which were scary, but really important, with this guy that things were getting pretty serious with. And so it checked a lot of boxes for me.
That's interesting. It sounds like the impetus of it, or at least some of it, was like, this objectively makes a lot of sense, satisfies both degrees, I can get it done. And who would have known, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the impact, the lasting impact it would have on your life, this one course, because from what I understand, you and your husband, or I guess boyfriend at that time, went back and taught at the course?
Yeah, we were guest speakers for about a decade after we graduated. And, you know, I should say that at the time we were taking the course, we were in our second year, we were making big decisions about where we would look for jobs, what jobs we would accept, if we ended up in the same city, would we live together? And so it was this very formative time. I don't think we realized it quite at the time, to your point. But the further we got out, and the more, you know, I'd stayed in touch with our professor. And so she would invite us back every year. And every year we would come back, and we were at that point, you know, working in different corporate roles, and we had young kids, and we would spend this 45-minute drive from, we live in San Francisco, and we would drive to Palo Alto, and we would do a bit of a state of the union on the way down, saying, okay, well, we're about to air our, you know, dirty laundry to the whole class. Like, is there anything you want to tell me first? And we would just realize, like, oh, this was such an important touch point for us. And as we, you know, continued to do this for a decade, we would tell her, this class was so impactful for us. The choices that we made, you know, for us to both be in jobs that were, you know, increasing in responsibility, for us to be adding complexity to our family by having, you know, one child and then another. And at that point, my mother had had a serious accident. So there was a caregiving role in that generation as well. The fact that we were both managing through all this complexity, using the tools and the concepts we learned in this class, was so meaningful to us. And that was one of the reasons when she retired and told me she wanted to write a book about the course, I absolutely encouraged her. And I said, you should write this down so that people who didn't get to study directly with you could benefit. And, you know, we had lunch about a year after that, and I asked her how the book was coming. And she told me at that point, she said, I haven't written a word. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. And she likes to joke that in typical MBA fashion, I said to her, well, maybe you need an accountability partner. Because I knew that it was a big project. And I had actually just launched the first employee resource group for working parents at the company I was working at the time. And that was done with a partner, a working dad in the legal team. And it was so helpful to have two of us to launch that effort. And so I suggested she have an accountability partner. I did not have myself in mind, but she looked at me and she said, that's a great idea, but I actually need more than that. I need a co-author. And you have been putting all these concepts to work in the trenches over the last decade, and I'd love for you to write this with me. And it was not something I anticipated, as I mentioned, but as soon as she said it, it just felt so right. I had this like full body yes experience. And so even though we advocate in our book to not make big life decisions in an instant, I said yes immediately, and we started collaborating.
I guess there's always an exception, hey?
Yes, it proves the rule. But, you know, we joke that, but we'd known each other for a long time. I respected her tremendously. We knew we could figure out working style that would work for both of us. And so it wasn't just a fly-by-night decision. It was born out of a lot of experience and familiarity. And, you know, I think that had I taken longer, I would absolutely have made the same decision. But it really surpassed both of our expectations in terms of what we got out of it, because that was in August of 2019. We started working on this, and not long after COVID hit, and the book became this anchor for us during a very uncertain and tumultuous time where we both lost people who are very close to us, where we just had our world turned upside down. And it was this constant that we both got to come to and be in flow together when we were focused on it. So it was really a gift.
It's so interesting. Quite the sequence of events of the, like I said earlier, these two worlds coming together from different walks of life. But you said when she asked you, it was a full body yes. Maybe just touch on, like, why was it such a full body yes? As you can look back now, I guess 5 years later, what was causing that, just like, to use your words again, a full body yes?
Well, first, I knew that the material was so important. And I had been, as I mentioned, using it, living it, kind of witnessing others in my workforce, in my workplace. At that point, I was leading a team, and I just saw how this content could benefit so many other people, people who are making decisions not holistically, right? Who I felt could benefit from some of these concepts. But also, Sean, I had done something interesting. I worked with a coach a number of years before that, and that coach had me write a 15-year vision to talk about the things that, you know, if I were to transport myself 15 years from then, and this was before I had kids, I would have accomplished or achieved. And one of them, you know, actually the first line in that 15-year vision was about how I picked up a copy of my book to bring to a friend for, we were having lunch, and I thought the book would be helpful to her. And I had no idea what book that was going to be. I had no idea, you know, at all the details of how that would happen, but I had put it out there in the universe. And you know, even though I have an MBA, I believe in putting things out there in the universe. And so I knew
they didn't teach you that in MBA school, did they?
No. We didn't do a whole lot of visioning. You know, strategic visioning, yes. Yeah. But, you know, this idea of like, what do you want to manifest was not necessarily part of my education formally. And I believe actually where I studied had more of that because it was in California and it was more than focused on just the tactical skills. So I knew that I had wanted to write a book. As we talked about earlier, my books were so important to me. And so this idea of collaborating with someone I respected on material I knew would have an impact that would eventually be a book was too good to pass up.
Having gone through the writing process and collaborating with Myra, what did you learn? I guess, are there any areas that you deepened your full body experience or exponential learning in Love and Money that, I guess, you weren't aware of prior to engaging in the writing process?
I know we're going to talk about the framework. So there's mm-hmm. a backbone of the book because everyone's personal situation is different, right? And so we wouldn't suppose to tell anyone what to do, but we wanted to give people a way to think about these big decisions in a way that allows them to make them holistically, but gives them a structure to follow because so many of these decisions feel overwhelming and daunting. And one way to make things feel less daunting is to break them down into manageable pieces. I was a management consultant in my first job after college, and that was essentially what we did for our clients, was to take these big thorny decisions, use frameworks, use structures to help simplify an overwhelming challenge. So the framework that we came up with as part of the book was not actually part of the course that my co-author taught. It was something that we developed together through our research for the book. We road tested it as part of the writing process, both on ourselves and on some early readers. And that was something that was a co-created element that was new. It was really useful because at this time, I mentioned we were writing during COVID, all of these big decisions came up, right? So we both made decisions about moving, for example, applied the same framework. My husband and I decided to stay in our current place. Myra and her husband decided to move. So we had these opportunities to see this framework in action and see how useful it was and experience personally how useful it was to us.
You mentioned about this framework, and I think you're right. When we see these big, well, I don't know if it's always big, but these daunting tasks or complex tasks, I think our brain likes to grasp, like in your case, the 5 C's or the 3 points, et cetera. Maybe just, can you touch on the 5 C's? And people can definitely get a copy of your book to dive into them deeper. Can you touch on the 5 of them? And maybe you could speak to one that resonates the most with you.
Sure. And let me just say before I articulate what the five C's are. The reason that we wanted a framework is what I mentioned earlier about having some structure to grab onto, but also because one of the things that we found, one of the elements in the research that leads to regret in decision-making is people making decisions too quickly. And so Daniel Kahneman talks about system one thinking and system two thinking. And we are often in system one thinking, which is, you know, very quick, very emotion-driven. And it's very useful to us when we're trying to get away from a predator, you know, when we were kind of surrounded by more predators. But system two thinking is more rational, is more logical, is more analytical, and that is harder for us to access. And so one of the things a framework does is encourage us to slow down to access that rational thinking that is hard for us to access sometimes when we are in moments of stress and uncertainty and trying to figure out, you know, something daunting. So that was part of the rationale for having a framework in the first place. So as you mentioned, our framework is called the five C's, and it's clarify what is most important to you. The second C is to communicate with the person or people who are most affected by the decision. The third C is to broaden your set of choices so that you're not thinking just in binary either or terms. The fourth C is to check in with trusted resources to get the outside view, as Annie Duke calls getting outside your own perspective. And the fifth C is consequences. So consider a broad range of consequences, both in the short term and in the medium and long term as well, which because of our short-term bias, we don't often do as humans. We think very close in. I want to talk about one that is most important to me. I mean, for me, the clarify step, it sounds so easy. Clarify what's most important to you, but it's both the most challenging step and the most important one. Because when you are clear on your core values, on the elements that are most important to you, it serves as a North Star that you can come back to as you step through the other C's. And you may actually, this is, you know, it's laid out in a linear form, but it's a very iterative process because you may think that one thing is important to you, go through the process, start, you know, checking in with other friends and family, and then realize, oh, actually, that's not at all what's important to me. It's something else. And go back and re-clarify and then move through the steps again. And so, you know, the reason that clarifying what's most important to us is so challenging is because of something called mimetic desire. And it's a term that French philosopher René Girard came up with, which means that our wants are powerfully influenced by others' wants. And as a financial planner, I'm sure you see this all the time, that, you know, people are, if they see their peers or, you know, their kids' classmates, families buying second homes, vacation homes, for example, they might have never wanted a vacation home. They might actually like to travel to different places on every trip. But if you start seeing the other people around you do something, you might think, huh, should we be buying a vacation home? Is that something that our family should be doing? Yeah, maybe we should. And we just start to have these influences. We don't even know half the time where things come from. They just sort of, we absorb them through osmosis. And so clarifying is about getting very quiet and doing that inner work to identify what is truly important to you, not what was important to your parents, not what's important to your partner, not what's important to the people who you surround yourself with, but really important to you. And it's only then when you get clear that you can then start to communicate with your partner, if you have one, about what is important to you and start to talk to them about what's important to them, because we don't make decisions in a vacuum. So it's important to do that step pretty early on in the process as well.
I can't recall the author, but there's a book called The One Thing. And I don't know if you've heard of this book.
Yeah, I've read it. Yeah.
He says, what is the one thing that's going to make everything else easy or unnecessary? And as you're walking through why clarify is so important, it just had me thinking about, yeah, I mean, I could try to be the best communicator in the world, but if I, you know, if I'm having ambivalence inside of myself or if I'm disconnected, what my values are, I'm going to have a hard time like empathetically being able to converse and see my spouse or whomever I'm making this big decision with. I really like this idea, clarify first. I think at times we might be drawn to communicate because we're always like, we got to communicate better. But if I don't know what I'm communicating, it's challenging. And it made me think about earlier, we were talking about how we have these unconscious money stories or these relationships with money that have been influenced from the past. It seems to me that this clarify allows you to use your words to do the inner work so that I guess we have a bit more peace and ease within ourselves and we can go through the rest of them. So I appreciate that clarify. And when you said about the financial planning side, I think this clarifying is so important because I have seen so many financial plans that are motivated by this desire to keep up with the Joneses or this social comparison that, to your point, we feel like we need to do this because the other people are doing it. And then we start crafting these financial plans that are inspired by other people's lives. So I agree with this clarify. I appreciate how you frame that. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because I think they can clarify in different ways. And some people, particularly who process by communication, may end up clarifying in the process of communicating with someone. So, you know, for example, just let's take the example of two people going on a first date, or maybe, you know, maybe it's not the first date, but it's you're about to go on a trip together, which is often when I say it's helpful to start having the money conversations with someone. And you're going on a trip together and you say, since we're about to go away together, I'd love to hear a little bit more about, you know, your budget for this trip and how you even think about, you know, money decisions. I'll go first. And so I like to say, you know, you should be ready in that conversation to share, you know, if you are from a family of coupon clippers, if you were, you know, from a family who was the opposite and who like just ignored money and hoped that, you know, there would be enough in the bank account when you handed that credit card over. Those are really helpful to be able to share with someone else. And it's not like, you know, you have to go away and in a cave for, you know, several months to clarify and then emerge ready to communicate with someone. But you should be able to talk about, you know, what you like to spend money on, what you don't like to spend money on, our budgets are external expressions of our values, right? And so to the extent that you can communicate those values with someone else before you get into the place where you're spending money, it's just going to serve you well.
I've heard you talk about some research that you were doing on couples who move in together prior to marriage versus couples who move in after marriage. And I believe there was a higher divorce rate in the couples that lived together prior to marriage. How, if anything at all, are these money influences and perhaps even a lack of clarity influencing those statistics?
Yeah, well, this was research that my then boyfriend and I did at the time when we were in Myra's class, because she had shared that statistic that couples that live together have higher divorce rates. And it seemed really counterintuitive to us. And because my boyfriend at the time and I were thinking of moving in together, we wanted to understand, why is that? Can anything be done to prevent it? How could we avoid that fate if we did end up moving in together? And so we dug into that data, and it turns out that there is something that could be done to prevent it. And that is being intentional about having the conversations before you move in to understand what is motivating you to make that decision. Does one person think that it's precursor to marriage and the other person thinks it's just a way to save on rent? Better to get that out, you know, ahead of time. Can you talk intentionally about how you're planning to combine finances so that you are being thoughtful about doing that and you don't run into challenges? So the more you can have these types of conversations about what it means to combine your life with someone, because living together, while it's not a, you know, marriage, it is actually almost as hard to dissolve as a marriage is. And so people end up in these arrangements that the problems come when people slide into that arrangement versus decide. And so if you're making that deliberate decision, if you're making that conscious choice, it actually mitigates the negative outcomes. It's when you go into that arrangement not having had any of those conversations and end up sort of staying in that arrangement because it's really hard to move out, that's when the challenges come.
I guess I'm really hearing this idea that when we start to say it's moving in together or have a coupleship, this love and money thing is unavoidable in a sense. And I like your statement there. If you slide or decide, and your comment on intentional was the, I guess, the part that could save these relationships. But I'm really hearing that whether we ignore it or not, money is influencing our love to some degree. And it's always best to clarify how, communicate, and so that we're not, I guess, avoiding the untold stories that are happening if we, to use your word, slide into a relationship together.
Yeah, I think, you know, I feel so fortunate to have taken this class when I did because, for example, and spoiler alert, we did decide to live together. And as you mentioned, you know, we did get married and we'll celebrate 15 years this fall. But we were going to be doing vastly different things for our careers immediately after graduating. So my husband was going to work for a hedge fund. I was going to work for a nonprofit. We were going to be making dramatically different salaries. And so we had to talk about, well, what is fair when it comes to contributing to our rent? Should we both be paying the same amount? Should we be paying a percentage of our salaries? How do we think about that? And again, these are really difficult conversations. I don't mean to imply that just because we took this class, it was smooth sailing and all of these conversations were like conflict-free and easy to have. They were really intimidating. They were very nerve-wracking and vulnerable, and they didn't always go well. Like sometimes we would get into a conversation and things would go sideways, or we would get upset with each other, or we would just like not understand the other person's point of view. But you know what it did is actually helped us build that muscle to push through the discomfort and, you know, continue to hash it out, continue to try to get to a point where we were finding a solution we could both live with, as opposed to, you know, we were not under no illusions that there would be this perfect solution, right? But we would find something that we felt like was a compromise we both could live with. And that was good training for marriage, as it turns out, because there are going to be any number of things that you disagree about, that you have different points of view about. But we've built that muscle over, you know, the last 18 years at this point of being together. And it is so much easier now to have those conversations with the foundation we have, as opposed to those first conversations. But I just want to be super clear that we're not advocating that, you know, you use this framework and you'll make the perfect decision every time. It's not a silver bullet, or that you have these conversations and they're all going to be, you know, easy, and then you'll, you know, cheers your glasses and, you know, be right off into the sunset. It's like, no, these are really challenging, but it's so much better to have them and push through the discomfort than to ignore them and just, you know, cross your fingers and hope for the best.
There's quite a few things I appreciate about that statement. When you said push through the discomfort and live with the outcome, kind of emphasized the last part you said there, but I appreciate you saying that, oh, are you not saying that you just do the 5 C's and everything's perfect? We live the best life, the best marriage, because as we know, life is full of these ups and downs. But the part I like that you're saying is having this framework or this guiding map can help you push through to live with decisions that you're comfortable with. And many times that's the way it has to be. It's not the most optimal decision for both of you every single time. And I have seen in the planning world too often where people are thinking that, oh, wait, there shouldn't be discomfort. Like, we should be able to figure this out. There's something wrong with us. And I'm really hearing you say, no, like, this is life. There's some hard decisions. However, if we have a grounding or a guiding framework, it can help us use the muscles, to your point. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, there's some research we did for our book by a professor named Jennifer Petriglieri, and she studies how dual career couples, so couples where both members are in the workforce, navigate that complex arrangement and make decisions over time. And what she has found is that it's not about what decisions those couples make together, but it's about how they make the decision. And that is really what influences successful decisions where they both look back and they say, yes, that was a good decision, or no, that was a bad decision. It's not, again, not what they decided, but how they decided. And so I think that that really underscores the importance of following a process that you both can agree on. Regardless, you know, again, there are monkey wrenches that get thrown at us all the time that you don't anticipate, right? So the framework is not going to guarantee that everything goes right, but it can guarantee that you both feel good about the way you made the decision and have confidence in your approach, which helps when an outcome is uncertain or is not the one you anticipated.
I like this, the way and the approach. I feel like it also sets the stage for, say, coupleships, and we've probably both have seen them where there's a dominant decision maker for whatever reason. It could be. It could be because their past experience with money as a child. It could just be the nature of the coupleship. Most times, like say when I'm seeing couples, I could see that there's a dominant one. And sometimes there's one that just goes with the flow because that's the way it has been. Even though deep down, everyone wants their voice to be heard. How have you experienced this framework allowing both voices to be heard?
Yeah, no, it's such a great question. And I do think that's a challenge for anyone who is working with a couple because of personalities or because of any number of reasons. There often is someone who's more engaged and someone who's less engaged. And yet you want the outcome to feel satisfactory to both. So I think what is important about the framework is it's not that you clarify together. You actually each are supposed to clarify what's most important to you. And so what you're communicating about then is one person sharing their perspective, the other person sharing that person's perspective. And we say that clarify and communicate is a bit of a dance. You know, you could imagine the visual of almost a DNA strand, a double helix. You're actually communicating not just to get your point of view across, but to be influenced by what the other person says. And there are a number of times where I'll have one point of view and my husband will have another point of view and we'll talk about it. You know, we may end up with one of our points of view, or we may end up somewhere in between. But the point is that we each were able to bring our voices to the table. And that's where I think it can be helpful to say, you know, again, if you're a financial planner, to say, well, hold on, I'm hearing a lot from person A about what's important to you. I'd love to just ask person B what's important to you, because I haven't heard as much from you, right? And so you're trying to get out both of those voices, encourage the communication if it's not happening naturally already, and start to surface any of the tensions or disagreements that might not be articulated, because if they don't come out in that particular session, they probably will come out at some point. And you don't want it to happen before it's too late when everything is, you know, already said and done.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point, because so often we have this one voice that isn't considered as much because there's a louder voice. And I like that comment you made about doing this by yourself, like to clarify. I think it almost gives someone permission to actually think about what they want to think about it, and not just what the loud, I'm saying this tongue in cheek, but the loud, boisterous other spouse that dominates the conversations. That was inside voice happening, but it happens. You have been doing a lot of work with the Money and Love Institute. Can you share more of what your mission is? What is this institute all about?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you how it came about, which is that I knew that I wanted to do something entrepreneurial for my next step in my career. And when the book came out, I frankly didn't know what that would be. But what I did was pay attention very closely to when we would give a talk or a workshop, to the people who would come up afterwards and say, this would be so helpful to me in my work in, you know, such and such work that I do. And one of those groups was financial advisors, was wealth advisors who work with people who come to them with money questions. But very quickly, as I'm sure you experience as well, it turns out there are relationship issues and sort of love elements that are underneath those money questions. And there is no training that you take. You know, there might be a behavioral finance class or, you know, continuing education around the psychology of money, but rarely are there trainings or tools that advisors have to integrate the elements of money and love in those conversations. And to the conversation we were just having, you know, you get to a better outcome for everyone, where everyone feels heard, everyone feels like all sides, all dimensions of the decision has been considered. And so the Institute is really designed to work with experts to help them have better conversations with their clients and help their clients make decisions that lead to more happiness, more prosperity, and more meaning in their lives.
I think that's so wonderful. That last part, more meaning in their lives. Another part that I'm really hearing here is that Myra, again, she's an economist, and economists are trained, there's an optimal financial calculation or formula. But I'm really hearing the nuance of human nature in this conversation. And this meaningful decision, for me, it's making me think that your work is around big life decisions, but the big life decision isn't necessarily evaluated by the financial outcome, like the optimal financial outcome. It's how do we consider both voices? And that might be a decision that comes with less money as an outcome, but there's more, to use your word, meaning behind it.
Well, yeah, and I think there's so many trends, right? So people are living longer than ever. Demographers estimate that a child born today has a 50% or more likelihood to live to be 100, right? And so if we're living longer, we're having careers that have a number of pivots in them. So my father worked for the same organization for his entire career. That is no longer the norm at all. People who are, you know, my generation and on down are having 5 to 7 careers, not just jobs, but careers in their span of their professional life. And so what advisors are moving towards is really helping people make these holistic decisions in a way that maximizes their wealth index. If you think about wealth being defined as more than just money, right? And so this idea of, well, what makes you feel like you have a wealthy life? That's worth examining. It's not just the dollars on the paper, but how do you, you know, have those conversations in a guided way that's structured and helps surface some of the things that maybe clients haven't even thought about themselves? And I'll give you an example, which is that my husband and I actually both are doing entrepreneurial things right now. So he started his own investment firm. I launched the Money and Love Institute, and we had to look at our finances and decide that it made sense to leave, you know, these corporate salaries that we were getting. So, you know, our income statement is very different than it was just a few years ago when we were both in those roles. But we are crafting our careers to build something that is meaningful to us, that will be enduring, and that, you know, at some point will be, we believe, back at those levels, but it requires a leap of faith. And so that's where having this framework and the process to step through together to make this decision jointly in a way where the outcome is uncertain, but we feel confident in the approach, and that gives us the ability to continue and to kind of grit through some of that uncertainty that we feel in this given moment. And I think that our example is going to become much more of the norm among couples going forward.
What gave you guys permission to step out and take that risk? I feel like you might have said you have younger kids, so you have 2 kids. I'm not sure how old they are. Stable corporate jobs, and I guess what motivated you or gave you that permission to just do it?
So there were a number of things. And actually, I have a newsletter and I just wrote about how I thought about this big decision to leave what was once my dream job. But I think COVID was a big influence, right? So it helped a lot of us quiet some of the noise and really think about what it was that we wanted to do more of. For in our example, we had a lot of, so our kids at the time were 4 and 7. They are 11 and almost 9 right now. And at the time we had jobs that we commuted to downtown. We had after school sitters. We had, you know, this whole web of childcare to make this precarious arrangement work. And overnight that all fell away. And suddenly, you know, our kids were in our dining room trying to have some semblance of a school experience. And we were trying to work remotely in two other rooms of our house that were never meant to be offices. But what we found over that time is that they actually really thrived with more of our attention. And we decided, you know, first we thought about moving, then we thought about, you know, some other things. And I really am my own guinea pig, and we use this process over and over to make this decision. But partly it was understanding that, you know, I mentioned my mom passed away. We don't know how long we have. We wanted to have more time with our kids while they still wanted to spend time with us. And so we didn't want to go back to the situation where we were outsourcing every minute of childcare that we could. We wanted to be available for the time where they would tell us things when we picked them up, you know, after school, or, you know, would ask us, you know, values-driven questions, right? They were getting old enough to start to have some of those things where it was like, oh, we don't want to outsource this part. This is actually really important for us to be doing ourselves. And so it wasn't the only thing that influenced us to make these big career changes, but was absolutely a factor.
You had alluded to, I think you called it a wealthy life beyond the numbers. And it sounds like that's part of your holistic wealthy life now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think both having the flexibility and autonomy and ability to decide how we want to spend our time is truly important. And even though I had a very flexible role before, it still required more hours in the week than, you know, I could meaningfully give to a role and still have time to spend with my family in the way that I wanted to. So I'm trying this entrepreneurial thing out. It's going well so far, but I'm still figuring it out. And so I like to say I'm still in the middle of the leap, but I had to let go of one trapeze in order to catch the next one.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I have a question that I have asked every guest. So I'm going to ask you, let's imagine now, maybe you jump to many other trapezes or not, but you're at end of life. There's no more trapezes. And it doesn't matter how old you are. You're sitting on a front porch looking out at a view that gives you complete peace, ease, and contentment. And you decide to write a letter to your children's children on what you learned is a key to have a happy and healthy relationship with money. What would be a key theme to that letter?
I love that. Well, I'd be in the mountains because the mountains always give me peace. And I actually would go back to clarifying what's most important to you and to knowing what is enough for you. I think that so many of the challenges come from not knowing you're enough and not knowing what is enough. And so if you know what you care about and you are able to have those elements in your life, then that is enough.
Thank you. Finding that enough is, I think, a peaceful place to be.
It's very elusive, right? But it's so important.
Yeah, I feel like it's elusive, but yet it could be closer than we often think.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciated this conversation. For listeners who want to find more out about the Money Love Institute, your wonderful book, where would you point everyone to?
Sure. So you can learn more about the Money and Love Institute at moneyloveinstitute.com. And the best place to find more about me is through LinkedIn. I'm at Abby Davison, and I share more about what I'm up to, including where I write my newsletter on Substack. So you can find it all there.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. It was a really wonderful conversation.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's conversation with Abby Davison. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Until next week, have yourself a good one. I'm on a mountain without a top. My wealth is measured in how I spend my time. But now I write freedom's story with every breath inhaled. Money is not the boat of life. It's just the wind in the sail.